NHL Land Podcast with David Amoyan.
Benvenuti, as one would say in Italy, and welcome to those who do not speak Italian. Thanks for tuning in to the 208th episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. Don't worry. David is alongside me. We're just throwing you a curveball. We're switching seats just for the top here. Now, unfortunately, at the top here, we're not going to be talking about football. As you probably have heard by now, there was an unfortunate incident 2 days ago in the Calgary-Juventus game revolving racism, Moise Kean, Bonucci, and others. So, David, simply, what is your takeaway from that incident 2 days later?
So where to begin? Sadly, this wasn't particularly surprising when you knew about Cagliari's history. Blaise Matuidi, who was also involved in this incident towards the end of it, had been a target of racist chants back then as well. There have been videos floating around of Balotelli taking a penalty kick where that had happened before. So while it's not surprising in Cagliari, I'd really like to say that, you know, don't assume that this problem, unfortunately, is just them and the city of Milano. We saw with Koulibaly, the Inter, which was the last time we opened the show this way because of these events. Unfortunately, this is really a systematic problem in Italy, a real black eye for the league. I think, you know, when you can just look at the way this was covered and the aftermath of what's happened since, there's really an environment that unfortunately fosters this type of behavior. Before we get into, you know, the individual people, I can tell you that very sadly, and I read, you know, a lot of the Italian press and I try to stay up to date. Unfortunately, the narrative is that the racist chants started after Kean celebrated. Which even had that happen after he celebrated, that in and of itself is really inappropriate. Say it had truly been that, which it wasn't. So if that's the justification already, the justification is a terrible one. But there is a great thread that's floating on Twitter by someone called @ENRYYDD, who did a really nice job showing all the highlights from the match where unfortunately these incidents were happening. And I have to say, there's so many disappointing things that came out of this. But to me, the coverage and trying to turn it into something that it wasn't is the most depressing. There was a journalist at Sky Sport who announced the match and then the post-match, and he tried to, you know, bring some sense to this. And, you know, when Cagliari's president tried to, you know, say that it really wasn't because of a black player, it would have happened anyway, and it was because of the celebrations, like, he tried to really bring some order and some truth to it, and it sounds like he might be fine. So really, a world completely upside down. I had tweeted too that, you know, unfortunately that type of event, as much as I love Italy and I love being there, that's one of the reasons why I live here in Boston, and I highlight Boston, not just US as a whole. As far as the other individuals, I thought Cagliari's president with his statement, you know, saying had it been Bernardeschi, it would have been the same, was definitely a problem. Backtracked a little bit with the statement on Cagliari, but really not that much. Then, of course, we had Bonucci, who with his very unfortunate statement saying that it was 50-50 responsibility, that Kean needs to learn how to celebrate and be respectful, and he was at fault for that as well. We also had Allegri, who just a few hours before, I had tweeted that Allegri is the master of communications, and he did said some right things, which we'll get to in a second. But he also put some of the blame on Kean. So really a very poor display all around. I know last night, early this morning, Bonucci tweeted, you know, posted something on Instagram, somewhat backtracking, but really not close to enough. So to me, my biggest takeaway is that you can't make it just about Cagliari and the fans there. I had some people tweet me, you know, it's just four idiots at a game. Sadly, I don't agree at all. And you can just look at the way it's been covered and the reaction from it abroad, quite different. So definitely a black eye for the league. As someone who loves calcio and covers it on this podcast and in other platforms, this is definitely something that gives me pause for certain. So I want to ask you, Alex, because obviously Everyone knows what a huge influencer you are with Chelsea, how much you know about the situation there. And there was somewhat of a similar incident that happened with one of your favorite players and Hudson-Odoi. I hope I'm saying his name correctly. And what really stands out to me is like the difference in the aftermath on it. So without getting too much on the Serie A thing, you know, maybe tell our listeners who might not be as familiar with that incident what the reaction was afterwards.
Yeah, so the situation involving Callum Hudson-Odoi was over the international break when he was actually receiving his first ever start with England. England were facing Montenegro in Montenegro. And according to Callum Hudson-Odoi, after the game, he was subjected to racist abuse, as was Danny Rose of Tottenham. Fans were making monkey noises and calling them monkeys throughout the game. Now, there was actually no gesturing or no incident specifically with Hudson-Odoi and Danny Rose gesturing back. Unlike Moise Kean, they never scored. However, Raheem Sterling, who is often a target of racist abuse, he did score and he did gesture back. Just nobody really talked about it, but he pulled out his ears, mocking the monkey chants. And after the game, no one was giving Raheem Sterling any blame for gesturing back. There was no blame put on the players whatsoever. It was fully condemning those fans. And while we're talking about how a certain manager handled the situation, talk about how Gareth Southgate, the England manager, handled the situation. Really a good quote. Unfortunate that he had to give a quote, but really, in my opinion, a very good quote. And this is what he said. "It's a sad evening. I'm not the authority on the subject. I'm a middle-aged white guy talking about racism. I just want my players to enjoy their experiences. I've not done enough. I'm sorry for that." So as you can tell, without me saying too much, quite a contrast in how things were handled after the game. So, David, now that I've given you the England side of things with the racist incident the other week, let's move back to the incident that happened in Calgary 2 days ago. What do you think should happen in the aftermath of that incident?
Yeah, so look, I appreciate you sharing that because I really want to drive home the point that to me, it's really not for idiots in the stand. It's really a problem of culture and how it's handled. And, you know, I'm old. My first memory of calcio was the Juve-Liverpool Coppa Campioni Champions League. It wasn't called that back in the 80s when hooligans killed over 30 Juve fans there. And I look at how England has radically taken that culture out, really gone out of the way to change things. And to me, the hope is maybe, you know, Serie A tries to maybe, this is one area where I think you can really learn a lot from what they're doing over there. So I really didn't appreciate Allegri, you know, kind of giving part of the blame to Kane, but I did really appreciate what Allegri said. And this is, you know, something that I've been saying for a long time. For me, the first solution is you hold the people accountable that are doing the behavior. You just ban them from the stadium. You know, you want to give them a 1 year ban up front and then they do it again out, whatever that is. To me, the important thing is that you hold the specific people accountable. I'm not a fan of, you know, holding the clubs accountable. And because to me, then you're giving these organized fan groups power over the club to say, hey, if you don't come in, reach our demands, which usually is tickets, support for away matches, different things, we will do this. You will be fined. You will lose points. If you think these fans, you know, the calcio and the team, yeah, it's important, but it's almost secondary to what they do. So to me, I'm not a fan of giving them power. I'm not a fan of punishing everyone that goes to the games. You know, we talked about it with Inter, with Koulibaly, you know, closing the stadium. Like 95, 97% of the fans that enter behave really well, and I don't see why they should be punished. So I agreed with Allegri. He called out the situation, and he says people need to be held accountable. I had people tweeting me, you know, we should have vigilante fans, and if I was there, I would punch someone that does that. You know, I hate to say it. It's easy to say there. If you see some of the people that are engaging in that behavior, I think you'd think twice before doing those things. So I'm a big fan of holding people accountable that way and trying to take a page out of what the Premier League did. I think what really stands out to me, as you said, is the sharp contrast in how it was denounced and the player that received the abuse wasn't held accountable. I want to close this segment, and we are going to get to Calcio because I really want to start talking about that over this situation. A journalist from Gazzetta dello Sport wrote this excellent tweet, and he said, you know, concerning, I'm going to translate it in English. He goes, concerning the racist boos, it doesn't matter the perception of the people in the stands or those watching on TV. The only thing that matters is the sensations of the people on the pitch that have black skin. People like us, white Europeans, cannot fully appreciate what these racist chants are. They transmit a sense of inferiority that we've never been the victims of. I think he said it really, really well. This kind of sentiment gives me hope. I have to tell you, like, I barely feel qualified to talk about Calcio, never mind these issues. So just a really bad page for Italian football. But enough of that. We have a great show still lined up for you. We're going to have our game picks with our friend Thousand Names. We have our dear friend Carlo Garganese, who came back to give us an overview of Serie A, really engaging interview. We, as usual, have the great Twitter questions from our listeners. And we're going to close, which you guys know is always a treat for me, with Brian Hyatt from Rolling Stone, who has a great book on Bruce Springsteen coming out. And we're going to talk a lot about the great articles that he's done. We also have a little bit of extra content for our patrons as well. And we really appreciate your support. But let's start talking about Calcio.
All right. Happy to announce we are going to get into a segment now that only grows in popularity, David. And that is, of course, Game Picks with you and Thousand Names, where we look ahead to the weekend in Serie A and you guys predict some games. So who do we got for this weekend?
Yeah, we need a little bit of comic relief, so thank you, Thousand Names. So, as usual, you guys know the drill by now. Thousand picks the three matches that both he and I are going to pick. I have the advantage of knowing what he picks ahead of time, but he's the one that picks the matches. So, a big match on paper, but maybe not that important for Juve and Serie A. For Milan, very important. The Rossoneri head to Turin to face Juve. And Thousand Names has Juve winning 2-1. Goals by Mandzukic, Dybala, and Calabria. Boy, I'd love to see what the odds are on Calabria scoring in this one. And his comment is, usually when Juve wins in Italy, they then really struggle in the Champions League right after. He said Ajax is going to destroy them. He does say Gattuso is going to continuously proving himself to be a very poor manager, and that other Gattuso, Piatek, is essentially marking himself. So in Italian, Juve-Milan 2-1. Mandzukic, Dybala, Calabria. Di solito quando la Juve vince in Italia, poi fa figuracce in Europa. L'Ajax li prende a pallate. Gattuso, allenatore modestissimo. Piatek si marca da solo. Like I mentioned, I don't think Juve is that motivated. They can clinch the Scudetto, I think, in the next two rounds. I actually think this is going to be a draw. I'll have it 1-1, and I'll give a goal to Piatek. I have a feeling Allegri is going to start Mandzukic again. I'm going to give him a goal. I'll give a goal to Pjanic on a free kick. I'm going to be nice to Pjanic and say he's on a roll now. Next match by Thousand Names, Atalanta, who are playing shortly before we post the episode. They're traveling short trip from Bergamo to Milano, playing to face Inter. Thousand has Inter winning 3-0. With goals by D'Ambrosio and a brace by Nainggolan. And he said Spalletti is going to reconquer San Siro by humiliating Gasperini. He says the second place is still possible for Inter and that Atalanta's focused on the Coppa Italia, which they might actually even be able to win. It's interesting, Atalanta both in the mix for Champions League and Coppa Italia. In Italian, Inter-Atalanta 3-0, D'Ambrosio doppietta Nainggolan. Spalletti si riprende San Siro umiliando Gasperini, secondo posto ancora possibile, Atalanta con la testa alla Coppa Italia. I'm going to agree with Thousand. I think Inter surging. I'm going to have them win 1-0, and I'm going to ride Icardi, which we'll get to in the questions. I'm going to give him the goal. Last match picked by Thousand, Roma traveling to Genoa, tough place to face Sampdoria. He has it 1-1. Goals di Quagliarella and Zecco, and the comment is the bomber di Castellammare, and that's a city right outside Napoli where Quagliarella, Donnarumma, and Di Marzio are all from. score again, and he's going to wave goodbye to Ronaldo at the top of the Capocannoniere race. Fausen thinks Quagliarella is going to get some distance for top striker. He does say that Audero is going to make a big mistake, and it's that Sampdoria essentially paid 20 million for him just to help out Juve. In Italian, Samp Roma 1-1, Quagliarella Zecco, il bomber di Castellammare segna ancora e saluta Ronaldo in testa alla classifica cannonieri. Papera di Audero, pagato 20 milioni per fare una favore alla Juve. I'm actually going to have Sampdoria winning. I just don't believe in this Roma anymore. Sampdoria not good on the road. They lost to Torino, very good at home. So I'm going to have Sampdoria winning 1-0, and I'm going to give a goal to De Frel, who is owned by Roma. So thank you, Thousand, for your picks, as always. If you guys want to pick along, just tweet us. So now let's talk more about some calcio. So we have two interviews today. The first one is all calcio related with our great friend Carlo Garganese from goal.com. Okay, so longtime listeners of Calcio Land know that our next guest really needs no introduction in general, but especially on this podcast, because when we started Calcio Land 2 years ago, our dear friend Carlo Garganese was one of the first five guests that I absolutely wanted to have on to launch the podcast. This is his third time. It's been way too long since we've had him on. He doesn't need much introduction, but for those of you that don't know, he is the global head of features for Goal's 37 editions worldwide. He's obviously an Italian football expert. So there's a lot going on in Serie A. So we wanted to catch up on the big storyline. So Carlo, it's always a real pleasure to have you on. Bentornato to Calcio Land.
Thanks, David. And thanks for having me back on. I love being on the show. It's one of my favorite shows out there, and it's great to be back.
Fantastic. So I'll tell you what, we're recording this on Wednesday, just so people know. There are some Serie A games that are going to kick off after we record. There's been a lot happening this week, but we're going to focus on the big storylines, and I'm kind of going to go in order of the standings and work our way down. So with Juve, there's really nothing much. Well, there's a lot to talk about off the pitch, but in Serie A, not much. It's all about the Champions League. And not only are you obviously a Serie A expert, you know very well the landscape in the Champions League. So very simply, let me ask you, how do you feel about Juve's chances of going all the way and finally lifting the elusive Champions League Cup that they've been after for quite some time now?
Big question. Well, if you'd asked me before the second leg of the last round against Atletico, I'd have said, you know, zero chance of going all the way. And I was absolutely stunned that Juventus managed to turn that around. And the main reason I say that is because anyone that's watched Juventus this season will know that they have not played well for most of the season, despite being so far ahead in Serie A. But, you know, around half of their wins this season have been by one goal, just grinding out results. There's been very little chemistry, you know, not playing very good football. And they just seemed very, very unlikely that they could get a three-goal win. So it was a huge surprise. But, you know, they performed incredibly in that game against Atletico, one of probably Juventus' all-time greatest performances in Europe. So, I mean, if Juventus can play like that for the rest of this Champions League season, then absolutely they can go all the way. The big question is if can they actually do that? Because you know, Max Allegri is quite a conservative coach, doesn't always, you know, release them from the shackles. So, you know, let's see if Juve can do that. I think they shouldn't have too many problems beating Ajax in the next round, provided they don't underestimate them like Real Madrid did. And then, you know, Manchester City probably in the semi-finals, which is going to be a really, really difficult game. I mean, they're just on fire in 2019. And then you're probably looking at Barca or Liverpool in the final. So, you know, it's going to be some very difficult games ahead. The other question mark I would have over Juventus is if they do get to the final, will the whole kind of mental block of, you know, the five finals in a row that Juventus have lost? I mean, I have no doubt about it that in Cardiff, that definitely played a part in the defeat. There just seems to be kind of like a psychological block there now, which is kind of understandable when you lose so many finals in a row. So will they be able to handle that? Obviously, having Cristiano Ronaldo will definitely help, because he's missed the Champions League. And I think definitely Juve will be looking to him to try and get them over the line.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Ronaldo, say they make the final, I think he can maybe help overcome that mental block. Because you were in Cardiff, I think we talked right before or after, and you had mentioned that it was really evident. So let's talk about a team that plays well. They don't have Sarri anymore, but there's still some elements of his system, and this is Napoli. They are going to be playing Arsenal next in the Europa League. There's really not many storylines for them in Serie A anymore. So let's focus on the Europa League. Tell me first on the matchup against Arsenal. How do you see that going? And in general, how do you feel about their chances in the Europa League beyond this round?
I think it's going to be a fascinating game. I would probably have it 50-50, to be honest with you. Maybe 51-49 in favour of Napoli because of the Ancelotti factor. But I think it's going to be a very, very close game. Arsenal are in great form at the moment. They've won their last three matches. I think they've won six of their last eight. And they've been in very good form during that time. They beat Man United at home. I think even the draw against Spurs in the North London derby, they should have won that game as well. Their best players, their most talented players are playing well. Ramsey, who obviously is joining Juve in the summer, is in great form. Scored a great goal at the weekend, or Monday night rather. And Ozil, who's kind of been on the sidelines for most of the season, even he's starting to pick up form now as well. So it's going to be a very difficult game for Napoli. Napoli, obviously, they have the firepower themselves. They're in good form, they're in good shape, scoring a lot of goals. Arsenal don't have a very good defence. They concede a lot of goals. They've conceded just under 40 goals, I think, in the Premier League this season. So Napoli can definitely score against them. But I think Ancelotti's the key, really, for this game. I mean, he is the master tactically in Europe. He very rarely gets it wrong in the big matches. And you would expect him to work out a way to get at Arsenal. So it's going to be a great game. If Napoli can get through, then I'd expect them to win their semi-final and get to the final, where they will probably meet Chelsea and their old manager Maurizio Sarri, which will be an amazing final. So let's hope they can do it.
Yeah, that would certainly be great for people like you and I that do content, for sure. So let me ask you next topic, Icardi. This has been an unbelievable soap opera, even for Serie A's standards. So let me ask you, in general, what's your take on the situation? I know you've written some tweets on it. And let me ask you, who do you blame more between Spalletti and Marotta, who I know is a figure that you've had a lot of thoughts over the years in general? So give me your big picture view of the situation, and let's play a little bit the blame game and let me know who you're zeroing in on.
Where do you start? I mean, they could make a Netflix series on this whole Icardi situation. It's just been unbelievable. I think, well, who do I blame more? I think it's been handled awfully by the club as a whole. I think both Marotta and Spalletti are massively to blame. If I was to single out one of the two more, I would probably single out Marotta. And the reason for that is obviously the buck stops at him. But anybody that's familiar with Marotta's career knows that he's always been known as this great diplomat throughout his career. I mean, I believe earlier in his career, he was actually nicknamed Kissinger after the American statesman, which in reality is probably not really a compliment. But he was given that nickname because he's supposed to be this master at knowing how to handle delicate political situations. And, you know, we saw at Juventus, of course, he was very good when it came to the club politics, handling the media, you know, ensuring that there was always harmony within the squad. And obviously, when he took over Inter in December, you know, his aim was to kind of put an end to this whole kind of Pazza Inter, the Inter that's always in chaos with infighting and crazy things always going on. and kind of make them more of a business-like club like Juventus, which is absolutely the right thing to do. The problem is that he's gone in there kind of mid-season with this kind of putting his foot down with this kind of scorched earth policy. And, you know, we saw even as early as January, we had 9 Galan being fined, you know, very public scenes. Same with Perisic about it being made public about him wanting to leave to join possibly Arsenal. And then, of course, you had the Icardi situation where he was stripped of the captaincy, which kind of regardless of who it was that pushed for that to happen, whether it was Spalletti, whether it was the players in the dressing room, or whether it was actually Marotta himself, I think the buck does stop with Marotta. And, you know, that was just, you know, my opinion is that Marotta should have put his foot down in cleaning up the club in the summer. He should have waited to the summer. He should have picked this moment better. And what has happened now is the club is in complete chaos. And, you know, they risk missing out on the top four. And if that happens, then, you know, it's an absolute disaster for Inter. I mean, it totally puts their whole plan, you know, to get back to the top in massive jeopardy. So I blame Marotta for that. I think he should have waited to the summer to really try and, you know, tear up the foundations of the club and make them more business-like, like at Juventus. Having said that, I think Spalletti is also very much to blame. But I think the problem with Spalletti is, you know, obviously he had that meltdown at the weekend, which was incredible. I couldn't believe what I was watching. but I think with Spalletti is that he knows that he's going to be let go at the end of the season. I think it's not much of a secret. He's going to be replaced at the end of the season, whatever happens now. So I think he doesn't care anymore, and he's not really that bothered whether he toes the party line. Yep. He's going to go with his principles, and I think that's very dangerous situation for Inter now, especially when he's trying to keep the harmony of the club. So it's a terrible situation for Inter really right now.
Yeah, for sure. And the way I see it, I think, you know, a lot of what Spalletti said makes a lot of sense on the Icardi side, but there's a difference between being right and being correct in the moment. At the end of the day, like you said, they have to do what's best for Inter and they have to get back to the Champions League. And it seems everyone's kind of running their own agenda there. So absolutely. Let's look on the other side of Milano. And, you know, I have to say, I was pretty impressed for a while with Gattuso. It just goes to show how quickly things can change. About 3 weeks ago, I would have felt that it was a lock that he was coming back next season. Now I don't feel that way so much. But we know there's been a lot of managerial changes at Milan since Allegri left. So let me ask you in general, looking on the squad that Milan has, who do you see kind of long-term building blocks for the club, regardless of who the manager is?
Well, I think the problem with Milan is that there's a big gap between their best players and their worst players at the starting 11. I think if you look straight through the spine of the team, they actually have probably four players who they can definitely build the next 5 to 10 years around. And, you know, you're looking at Donnarumma in goal, who's going to be one of the best goalkeepers in the world, if he isn't already. Then you have Romagnoli at centre-back, who's probably Italy's best young defender. And then you got Paqueta in midfield, who, you know, still need to see a little bit more of him, but he definitely oozes a kind of elegance and class and that Brazilian samba flair. So he's definitely a very exciting player to watch. And then obviously up front, you've got Piontek, who's, you know, a real killer in front of goal. Maybe needs the service sometimes, but, you know, he's going to score a lot of goals if you give him the service. So I think in those four players especially, you've definitely got a good spine to build around. It's just about, you know, building around them, really. So I think Milan are in a good position in that sense. But they need to qualify for the Champions League. And like you said, they've gone on a bad run of form now. I think they've probably been playing bad since the Coppa Italia semi-final first leg, where they were really lucky to get a 0-0. They got really destroyed in that game. They've been bad for a while now. So they need to pick it up really quickly, because if they don't get in the Champions League, then again, like we're saying with Inter, it kind of jeopardizes their whole plan for the future, really.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Champions League more broadly. So we talked about both Inter and Milan, for different reasons, have been struggling. We have a surging Lazio. We have Roma, who's hanging on mainly because the other teams are struggling. And we have Atalanta, who despite their low payroll, is definitely having a very good season. So when you look at the landscape, let's give Juve and Napoli, obviously given for the Champions League. How do you see the other two spots shaken out?
It's so hard to predict. I mean, I think, you know, realistically, you could probably go from third place down to ninth and say any two teams, from there could potentially get in the Champions League. I mean, if you gun to the head, I think I'd probably go Inter still for third. They've got a slight advantage in the standings, which will definitely be helpful because I can see all the teams dropping points regularly between now and the end of the season. Fourth place, I mean, I would love to see Milan make it because I think it's important for Italian football to have a strong Inter and a strong Milan, and we want those two teams to be back to their best, you know, as soon as possible. But, you know, they've really hit a bad run of form. They've got a few injuries now. I think Paqueta's going to be out for a couple of weeks. So I'm worried about Milan, I have to say. Atalanta are in fantastic form, but they've got a real nightmare running. I think they have to play the top three all the way from home. So it's going to be, I know they're very good away from home, Atalanta, but
they are.
So that's going to be really, really tough for them. I think, as you mentioned, Roma are a mess. I think Lazio, and no offense to Lazio fans, I don't particularly want to get in the Champions League, but they're in good form. Serge Milinkovic-Savic is getting back to something close to his best, you know, after a bad start to the season. And they've got the easiest run in. The only thing against them, I'd say, is that they've got quite a lot of games to catch up on, and they're still in the Coppa Italia. So it's weather tiredness and a few injuries could come in. But in terms of the running, they've definitely got the easiest running. So if they take care of the games they should win, you know, they can make it. So I'm going to go Inter and Lazio.
Yeah, I'm leaning that way too. Right now. So let me ask you one last Serie A question. There's a couple of other topics I want to talk to you about. Obviously, you know, we talked a lot about the top teams. You've mentioned some really good players. You're an astute observer of Serie A as a whole. Are there maybe some under the radar players that have really stood out to you this season?
Yeah, I mean, some of these may not necessarily be under the radar for your Serie A fans, but for those who may be more casual observers of Serie A, you know, they won't necessarily be familiar with. So I'll try and include some of them as well. From Napoli, I would say that the player that I've really fallen in love with this season from Serie A is Fabian Ruiz, the Spaniard, left-footed, amazing, beautiful left foot, so cultured, so elegant. I don't know how. Don't think he's that well known outside of Serie A still. So that's why I've included him. He's beautiful. I love him. He's going to be a great midfielder. And also for Napoli, I'd probably go for Kevin Malcuit, the right back.
Yeah.
Who bit of a late bloomer until the Juventus game, where he had a bit of a nightmare. Since then, he hasn't played so much. He was really one of the surprises of the season. Really fast down the right wing, overlapping attacking fullback. He's been great this season. So I picked those two from Napoli. Elsewhere, I'd probably go for Acerbi from Lazio. Very underrated centre-back for me. I think he's done a really good job of replacing De Vrij. Elsewhere, a player who's really started to pick it up recently, someone who I predicted at the start of the season, because I watched him play in a pre-season friendly live. I was at the stadium to watch Sampdoria against Watford. And he was outstanding in that game. He scored a goal. Omar Colley, centre-back for Sampdoria. Real man mountain. Kind of in the Koulibaly kind of mold, but maybe not as quick, but very commanding, imposing centre-back. And he's been in good form recently for Samp. So I really like the look of him. He's definitely one to watch out for. And then probably I'd go one of your favourites. I know you were the guy that kind of introduced everyone to him. Lazzari from Spal, I think, he definitely deserves a bigger club. Real lightning quick down the right wing and always beats his man. I think I remember a game in which he really gave Asamoah of Inter a real torrid time. And Asamoah is, you know, one of the most difficult fullbacks to beat one-on-one. And he was beating him time and time again. So that kind of said everything. So yeah, probably Lazzari from Spal would be my last choice.
Yeah, really good shouts. Very well said. So let's talk about a subject that both you and I really like, although it's been rather difficult recently. So when I had you on the first time, we were both in awe of Sarri ball. Both you and I really would have liked Napoli to win the Scudetto last year. He joined Chelsea. I think people that knew Sarri could have seen some of these issues coming. So very simply, are you surprised by anything at all that happened during Sarri's tenure at Chelsea so far?
I mean, if we can play the blame game, I think it's totally wrong. I mean, he's lost the fan base generally, or at least he's lost the fans that go to the stadium. They're very much against him. They're charging against him. And I think that's unfair, because I think they failed to understand the situation that Sarri was kind of flung into, really. I mean, you've got to remember that this Sarri was brought into Chelsea. The club was in total chaos. He was brought in two and a half weeks before the season started. You know, there was the whole legal situation with Antonio Conte. Conte, the crazy situation of Conte taking pre-season training while he was about to be sacked. So he had no preparation time, and anybody that's familiar with Sarri's work knows that, you know, his systems, very repetitive action, they take a long time for the players to get familiar with it. So he had 2.5 weeks before the start of the season. The transfer work of the club was very poor as well. And he was crying out for a striker. Diego Costa wasn't replaced until Higuain finally, belatedly came in you know, January. So Sarri wasn't given the tools to work with either. I think the problem with Sarri's football is that he needs the players that can play the kind of short passing game, and that can also, you know, have the intensity, the high press. The defenders need to be able to press high up the pitch. He hasn't had the players to do this, the squad that he's got at his disposal. And, you know, that the transfers that they made didn't help him either. So you know, he's been a bit unlucky in that sense. And I'd also say, and I know, you know, Pep Guardiola was kind of in a similar situation in his first season, where he also was very close to not qualifying for the Champions League. Yeah. Sarri is someone that you really do need to give time to. I don't think that's going to happen. And I would say that he is also partly to blame. And I think, as you alluded to, he lacks flexibility as a coach. He's, you know, even at Napoli, he had one way of playing. He doesn't have a plan B. I think the opposition know how to set up against Sarri teams. Yeah. You know, they know that if you defend deep, if you pack the middle of the pitch, you know, you can stop them finding those gaps to get in behind you. Jorginho is someone that can be targeted on the counter-attack and on transitions, because as brilliant as he is at kind of playing that short passing game and controlling the midfield, he is vulnerable in defensively in terms of screening the defence. He's not very good positionally. So teams have targeted that as well. And I think this is kind of maybe the big difference between, say, Sarri and, say, someone like Allegri or Ancelotti or Lippi during his heyday, that these coaches could, you know, they didn't just have one way of playing. They could flourish with all kinds of players. They could adapt to their players. Whereas I think Sarri kind of has one way of playing, and the players have to adapt to his style. And I think at Chelsea, he hasn't really had the players to do that. Not certainly not, you know, to make them go on and win the league or to win the Champions League or, you know, a big trophy, major trophy. So that's the problem with Sarri. And I do worry for him now, to be honest with you, because I think that with the transfer ban coming in as well, even if he was to survive until next season, I don't see how he could improve the team. So, yeah, it's a shame, because he's brilliant to watch, but, you know, he's just how it's been, how it's gone, really.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I'm going to set you up, because you were a voice in the wilderness against VAR when it first came out. You were vehemently against it. I thought the first season in Serie A was pretty good, and it's been a disaster since. So let me ask you your opinion on VAR in general. And one of our listeners, Leon Galante, wanted me to ask you, since you're so in tune with the game globally, are there any changes that you see coming, maybe with rules, technology, or anything at all, anything that you kind of see that might change the landscape in any way of the football world?
The last part of that question first. In terms of rule changes, I mean, I don't know if this has any relation to VAR, but it was certainly a topic that caused a lot of debate after the Manchester United PSG match. And I think everyone will remember that the United got a last-minute penalty for very, very controversial handball. You know, let's be honest, it was a particular decision. But actually, by the rules next season, that will actually always be a penalty, because the new rules from next season will be that if your arms are not in what they're calling like a natural silhouette of the body, and the ball hits your hand, regardless of whether it's deliberate or accidental, it will be given a penalty if you handle it in the penalty area. So that is going to cause absolute chaos next season. And obviously VAR is going to play a part in that. So that is definitely something to watch out for in terms of how the rules are going to change. I mean, I don't know whether that penalty should have been given, because I think the rules are not coming in until next season. Obviously, VAR made the decision that it was a penalty. So that's definitely going to cause a few issues next season. In terms of VAR in general, I mean, initially, the main reason why I was so against VAR is because, you know, I believe that it was destroy football's soul. You know, that there was going to be too many delays, too many stoppages. You know, you were going to have players who didn't know whether to celebrate or not, or who celebrated and had the goal, you know, ruled out. And, you know, that was my concern. And I think, even though, like you said, they got the decision, you know, they did all right in the first season in Serie A anyway. There was still a lot of delays, you know, 4 or 5 minutes between. And I just, all the stoppages, I think in America, I think it's probably not so much of a big of an issue, because obviously in you know, the American sports, there's always delays. Especially like in American football. But I think in Europe, I think the people feel a little bit more, they want the game to flow a little bit more, you know. So that was where I was coming from on that. Having said that, I think it has improved. I think that there've been less delays now. So in that sense, I think it has improved this season. But like you said, I think there have been other issues which have definitely come to the fore in Serie A. And let me just point out that it's actually been a lot worse in other leagues. Serie A is actually probably the best league for the VAR right now. But I think it's the inconsistency, really, of when a referee goes to make a review and when he doesn't. And that's the biggest problem right now. I think that the best example of that was probably the Roma versus Porto game in the Champions League, where Porto got a penalty within like 3 or 4 minutes to go. Where the referee, you know, made a review at pitch side, gave the penalty, and then a few minutes later you had a trip in the box on a Roma player on Patrick Schick, and the referee didn't go and make the pitch side review. You know, those watching the screen basically told him not to go and check it out. So the kind of inconsistency, really, between when you go and make a review, when you don't make a review. You know, different games, you know, the interpretation between different referees and different officials that are in the booth checking out on the video. So that has been a big problem in Serie A this season, and also in the Champions League as well. And that's something that I'm not sure really how you can solve it. I think some people, I think it might have even been you that mentioned, you know, maybe you could have one place where everything is done from in terms of the reviews. But it's something which I don't really see a solution from in its current form. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens, really. But definitely, it's not going to end the debate over referees, put it that way.
That's for sure. So, Carlo, I think everyone heard your brilliance with your calcio analysis. But on goal, as I mentioned at the top, you are the global head of features for 37 editions. There's a lot going on the site. So tell our listeners about recent initiatives or what they can expect if they check out your content, which is really outstanding.
Well, coming up, obviously, we're now in April, so everything is going to be on the end of the season, especially the Champions League. You know, we're in the quarterfinal stages now, so we're going to have lots of great content and lots of great interviews with players that are still in the Champions League. We've got a big build up for the Champions League quarterfinals next week. I think one piece I'd definitely recommend checking out is our Italian football writer Mark Doyle, who's based in Bologna. He's a fantastic writer. He's doing a feature on Cristiano Ronaldo, kind of looking at whether he's actually the best header of a ball in the history of football, which, you know, sounds like a big bold thing, but you know, after the two headers against Atletico in the last round, it's definitely something that's worth analysing. I mean, it's probably one quality of Ronaldo that's probably underrated, really, just how good Ronaldo is in the air. I mean, he's incredible. His leap, the way he kind of hangs in the air, a bit like kind of like Fabio Cannavaro used to just hang in the air. It's incredible. And the power that he gets in his headers, he's unbelievable. So that's going to be a piece to look out for on Monday, and we'll have plenty of content like that coming up. In terms of recent initiatives, I would recommend that everybody checks out our annual Next Gen list of the 50 best teenagers in world football. That went out a couple of weeks ago. You can find it easily if you Google Next Gen, you know, 50 best teenagers goal, you'll find it. And there's a few Serie A players in there. Well, actually more than a few. There's a few Italian players in there, including the man of the moment, Moise Keane, who if we were doing the voting now, probably would have challenged to actually win the award. But he's in the top 10. So check that out, and you can kind of see who the next stars of tomorrow are, and where the Serie A players rank on that list. That was kind of our big initiative that we've done in 2019. So definitely worth checking it out.
Awesome. Well, Carlo, I can't thank you enough. You are one of our original guests. I promise, as long as you're up for it, we won't have so much time pass between your appearances, because I think everyone really saw what you bring to the table. So thanks so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to chat culture with you.
Yeah, you're welcome, David. I love being on the show. It's a fantastic show. So definitely we'll do it again soon.
Really great stuff there from Carlo, and it's really been way too long since we've had him on. He really is a great voice for Calcioland. And also, David, some great voices for Calcioland are listeners who give great Twitter questions, and we have another great slate of Twitter questions for today's episode. So let's jump right into it, shall we? First question, David, should Juve hire a top-notch PR firm as their next big addition?
It's been a rough stretch for Juve, no doubt about it. You guys remember the tweet supporting Ronaldo in the midst of when there was a lot of coverage on the press on the allegations. You know, again, it goes back to what I was saying at the top. I don't see it as four idiots in the stands. I really see it as kind of like a cultural problem with this. You would have thought, you know, I guess a lot of people assumed Juve was going to show a strong support for Kane. The thing they did, at least, is they did post an interview with Chiellini, who was much better spoken than Bonucci on the subject. And that's really kind of how they addressed the situation. They also showed Kane going to visit children in a hospital. I mean, speaking of PR, I can't believe, of all people, Juve let Bonucci go speak to the media after that match with what happened. But I could get lost just talking about that. The one thing I'll say is definitely don't blame the folks that run the social media account on Juve for this. It's definitely decisions done way over their pay grades on how these situations are handled. You know, Juve is a publicly traded company. I think they also have to be careful with what they say, how it impacts their stock market. But I don't see how, you know, showing support to one of their players would have hurt that. So this is just a different Juve. I mean, all you have to do is look at the way, you know, Buffon, Marchisio, Del Piero left. This is a pretty cutthroat Juve. You know, Andrea Agnelli's done a lot of things really well. I wouldn't say he's the most warm and fuzzy guy. I watched this documentary on HBO on Gianni Agnelli. That's the Juve that I always thought in my mind growing up. And it just hasn't been the same club for quite some time. So I don't know if PR firm can really help, but I think the culture at Juve has certainly changed. That's for sure.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Who do you see as a better fit for Roma between Giampaolo and Gattuso?
Yeah, so I know there's been links of Gattuso to Roma. Doesn't sound like the worst
fit in the world, you know, if he were to leave Milan, which at this point looks pretty likely. And, you know, I go back to what our new saying, Alex, you know, are we just a two-game losing streak from sounding like idiots? And I certainly do with Gattuso. But to me, Gianpaolo, and I've been saying it for a while, I think he's next in line of those managers on upper mid-table teams looking to get their shot at a big, big job. So I'd say Gianpaolo has more experience than Gattuso. He's done, although Gattuso is already at a bigger club than Roma at Milan, but I think Gianpaolo is ready to take to get a shot at a club like Roma. So between the two, I'm going to pick Gianpaolo for that job.
All right, fair enough. David, how about this? Who do you think would be a better profile to be Roma's next sporting director?
So, you know, there's kind of like three routes that are out there. Go the internal, which would be promoting Frederic Massara, who's been the right-hand man of Sabatini and Monchi, having Balzaretti and Totti supporting him. That doesn't sound like such a bad solution to me. Go with another foreign sporting director after Monchi, which to me sounds like an absolute disaster. I think you have to know the culture of the city of Rome, someone who knows the league. So I think out of all, that's the worst one. And the other option is go with someone that knows Serie A. So you could bring back Sabatini, although there is not a great relationship between him and Pallotta, or go for Torino sporting director Petracchi, who is getting a lot of buzz for that job. And I got to say, you look at how that Torino team is built, I'm really, really impressed. And I go back to the fact that Atalanta is the sexy pick, but Torino, really well run too. So I'm going to say Petracchi, I think, would be an intriguing addition for Roma if they decide not to go with the internal solution. The more I think about it, I think Petracchi deserves a shot, and that's who I would go for.
Okay, here's a good one, David. Who has a better legacy right now between Di Francesco and Sarri?
I'm curious to get your take on this. So I think Di Francesco definitely looks a lot better now than a few weeks ago when he was sacked. I think there's also been talk of him potentially returning to Roma because the Ranieri thing, and it's not Ranieri's fault, really isn't working out. So I think, you know, Monchi really has become, been getting all the blame, and probably rightfully so. Sarri, on the other hand, I think no matter what happens to Sarri the rest of his career, the worst case scenario for him is his legacy is kind of going to be the new version of Zeman. Zeman, you know, to maybe younger listeners, he's known as the guy that always talks trash about Juve at Roma and smoking cigarettes, but he really was a genius offensive mind at Foggia with his offensive trio, even what he did at Roma earlier in his career. So to me, in my opinion, worst case scenario, Sarri is going to be remembered that way. He's going to have a strong legacy. I think for Di Francesco, I mean, he's a younger manager, still has plenty of time and ability, I think, to do well. But if the question is right now, I would say Sarri.
Yeah, and regarding Sarri, now that he started Callum Hudson-Odoi yesterday, I now think he's more likely to stay. But I do agree with that legacy answer from you. Okay, David, next Twitter question. Which young Serie A striker excites you the most between Moise Kane, Lautaro Martinez, and Piontek?
Great question. So let's break them down, their pros and cons, and then I'll get to my answer. So I think Kane probably has the most potential, also has the smallest sample size out of these, although that sample size is really pretty juicy and unbelievable, kind of like when Piontek came on the scene at Genoa and at the beginning at Milan. Piontek, you know, came from Poland. We didn't know much about him. Kane's been a hot name prospect for a while, also because he's with Mino Raiola. So probably you could say Kane probably has the highest upside, also because we know the least about him. I've said a few weeks ago, Lautaro Martinez to me is ready to get into one of my favorite categories of players, strikers who shouldn't be judged on goals alone because of what else they do. I think he's a very complete player. I thought he handled very well the Icardi situation. And Piontek is just in the box, is just a killer. I'd say out of the three, definitely the best pure scorer, although Kane in his sample size has shown that he could. So I'm going to say, if the word is excite, I could say Kane, But, you know, right now, if I had to say the safest bet, probably Piontek, assuming he has good service. I think Lautaro is going to have a very good career, even if he doesn't score a ton. But I'd be shocked if, you know, he consistently has seasons with 15 to 20 goals. I could see him more, maybe 12 to 15, but also helping the team a lot.
All right, David, this next question you've already had a few times, and I imagine, knowing what you do, you're going to get it a lot more. If you had to put odds on it, how likely is it that Mauro Icardi is on Inter next season?
So I've been steadfast about this throughout the whole Icardi drama. I've always said, and again, I want to stress my personal opinion, not something I've been told, not information. I'm on record that I think Icardi's staying at Inter. To me, scores a few more goals, has a few more strong performances. A lot is going to be forgotten of all this. Winning cures that. He helps bring Inter back to the Champions League. I think that would go a long ways. Now, that could also help reestablish his transfer value, of course, but I think it really comes, he still comes with a lot of baggage as long as he has Wanda as his agent. I've said it all along. I think both him and Wanda look to me like desperate to stay at Inter. I think they simply overplayed their hand, trying to get higher wages, a new contract. Inter called their bluff. And this is the situation that we're in. My guess is that it's much more between the two scenarios. I mean, it's more likely that Icardi stays and that it's both Spalletti and Perisic who leave, if I had to bet. I don't definitely see a scenario where all three come back. I think at least one Icardi could go and the other two stay. More likely, two out of the three leave. And my guess, Icardi is the one that stays.
All right, David, staying on Mauro Icardi, what did you make of Inter's Kevin Nord statement on Icardi? And are ultras still influential within clubs?
So let's answer the second part first. Yeah, in a lot of cases, ultra groups are still very influential with teams. We also saw Cagliari kind of protecting their own. This happens in a lot of places. You contrast it to Juve with their organized groups. They're kind of trying to take the Premier League model. And instead of having organized fan bases, they really want just regular paying customers, tourists and whatnot. So it depends on the club. But still in Italy overall, they still have a strong level of influence within the club. For those that didn't see it, the Curva Nord Inter's organized groups, they wrote a letter saying under no circumstance do they want Icardi back next season. I think this was their second or third letter this year. They had one on the Koulibaly incident that, you know, better that we avoid that one. But on Icardi, look, they've had a very difficult relationship in the past. They've had a reconciliation in the past. But, you know, things can change. As I've said, not that long ago, Milan and Donnarumma, that situation looked like there was no way it could be resolved without Donnarumma getting rid of Raiola. Raiola's still there, and there was a great relationship between Milan Ultras and Donnarumma. So things can change, but this Icardi one is a particularly sticky.
Okay, David, next Twitter question. How do you rate this particular Serie A season compared to recent ones?
So I would say last season was definitely one for the ages with that title race between Juve and Napoli, which was really incredible. Definitely the strongest one we've had in a while, just a lot of drama. We also had the last Champions League spot decided in the last few minutes of the match between Lazio and Inter. So really hard to top one. I think this one, there really was no title race at any point. The Champions League race is definitely very exciting. The race to avoid relegation is exciting. The one thing that I'll say, the most exciting thing for me this season is the amount of young breakout stars in Serie A. We've had Kane, Zaniolo, Barella really establishing himself. So that's good. I think Mancini's done really nice work with the Italian national team. We're seeing more Italians playing. And the other good thing about this season is Milan and Inter, for the most part, are making progress. So that should help long term. So I see this season more as a transition season with new stars emerging and hopefully Milan and Inter being able both to get back to the Champions League, as much as I would like to see Lazio as well. That would benefit the league more. So I could think this could be a very good stepping stone for Serie A this season.
Okay, how about this? What is your favorite? I love this question, David. What is your favorite Serie A kit of this season?
So this is going to be a boring answer, but the ones that I like best this season, there isn't really of the new ones that really, really stand out to me, but I really enjoyed the classics. I still think Sampdoria, Genoa, and Torino, who barely changed their jerseys, are fantastic. The Fiorentina one, it's not that different than usual, but it looks particularly crisp and sharp. So those are my picks. I kind of like the Milan one. The first one with Puma is nice, but it's not, you know, particularly different. But I'm going to stick with the classic. I mean, I think you can never go wrong picking Sampdoria's as the best one.
Yeah, I remember answering this earlier in the year. I love Sampdoria's. I always do. I just love the classic looks as well. But a very more modern look, I do like Inter's alternate. I will give a shout to Inter's alternate. All right. How about this? If Chievo got relegated, do you see them folding?
Absolutely not, because Chievo have been a very solid club. I know they got a deduction for points for those inflated plus Valencia at the beginning of the season, but overall they're a financially stable club. They've been able to stay in Serie A for a really long time. It actually really wouldn't surprise me if they come right back to Serie A. They really strike me as a club that, you know, their mentality, their way of playing is almost better suited for Serie B than Serie A. So no, actually between the two, if I had to bet, I think it's more likely that they come back to Serie A than anything else.
All right, David, this is an interesting one. Which Serie A club most resembles Chelsea?
So I'm curious to get your take. Obviously, you become a Serie A expert. Maybe you'll pick Milan because that's your favorite Serie A team, and we all know Chelsea is your club. So I've thought a lot about it. And, you know, looking from the outside in, you know, when I look at Chelsea, it's a club that, you know, has won, you know, in both the Champions League, has won the league, and also has a lot of drama surrounding them pretty consistently. So I'm going to say Inter is the one that resembles the most. I mean, now granted, Inter hasn't won the title recently because of Juve, but they are the last Italian team to have won the Champions League. We all know about Pazza Inter. So that's my pick. What about you, Alex? Is there anyone else that stands out to you?
Well, it's funny, David. I would choose Inter and Milan based on Inter's current dysfunction and instability, and Milan over the past couple of years of having dysfunction and instability, which really doesn't mean I'm thinking very highly of my club, but also they are big clubs, and as is Chelsea. But I would agree. I'm going to piggyback off of your answer. Any club I'd have to compare them to, I think it would be Inter.
I know for the most part, this podcast was pretty somber. I was pretty shaken by what happened, and we wanted to be respectful. But we are going to close on something that makes me very happy. You guys know pop culture has always been a part of our podcast. So we're going to close with Brian Hyatt of Rolling Stone magazine. We're going to discuss his book on Bruce Springsteen, which is really, really excellent. Talk about some other pop culture topics, including Jordan Peele, Twitter, Mick Jagger. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview.
So today is like Christmas morning for me because we have another great returning guest. I always like to say that rappers want to be NBA players, NBA players want to be rappers, and a lot of sports writers like me actually really want to be writing about music and films. And our next guest is really one of my favorite writers in the industry. I've had the pleasure of having him on about a year ago, and he's back today. This is Brian Hyatt of Rolling Stone magazine, where he's a feature writer. He's the host of the outstanding Rolling Stone Music Now podcast, where I learn all sorts of stuff. Today, I learned that Rob Thomas used to be a Ministry fan, which was pretty cool. But more importantly, we're here to talk about his new book that just came out on Bruce Springsteen. It's called The Stories Behind the Songs. You get the inside scoop on literally every officially released studio track from Springsteen. We're going to get into a little bit Brian's career, so you'll see why he's the ideal person for this. But before we get to that, Brian, thank you so much for coming back to Calcioland. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and I always appreciate the support, man.
Awesome, man. Okay, so let's talk about this book. So a lot of books have been written about Springsteen, but this format, I think, is really outstanding. And I think it really hits up the way people consume content these days. So tell me a little bit about the idea of the book and why you think this is different than a lot of the other biographies we've gotten on Springsteen so far.
Well, first of all, I think it's different because it's not really a biography. It sort of ends up sort of being one, but the idea is basically, like you said, to tell the story individually of each and every Bruce Springsteen song. And it's just broken down into, you know, some 300 entries separated by album, and each album includes the outtakes for that album, because Bruce is the kind of guy who, not every album, but many albums, there are released outtakes that came out later for a bunch of his albums. So I grouped those all together. And, you know, I think what's cool about this book is, first of all, it's actually like a coffee table book, in the sense that it's, you know, a large format book with a little ton of photos, but it's also hopefully like a real book. So it's kind of hopefully best of both worlds. It looks nice on your coffee table, and you really can and should pick it up and read it. And it's deeply reported. I did, like, first of all, I've talked to Bruce 5 different times, in career spanning interviews. And then I did 60 hours of new interviews with the E Street Band, with producers, with pretty much all the major collaborators from Bruce's career, going from 1973 all the way to 2014 or whatever. And so it's reported and researched. And it's full of it. Both, if you don't know the stories, it'll tell you the stories. If you do know all the stories, it tells them with a lot of new information you've never seen before in any other book. And I'm really pleased that hardcore Bruce fans seem to be really loving it. And then people who are just learning about Bruce also like it. And that's, you know, I think if you can please the hardcore fans, then hopefully you without going too far in their direction, then you can please everyone else, hopefully.
Yeah, what stands out to me, the reason why I think it's perfect for this era of content is, you know, people have short attention spans. They can jump from one song to another that they really like. So I think the concept is fantastic. Was this your idea, or did someone pitch it to you?
No, you know, the British publisher came to me and said, we're looking for someone to do this. We think you'd be the perfect person. And I really didn't have time, honestly, to do this. I've said this before, but the reason I agreed to do it is just I knew that a lot of people would take on these kind of projects, because there's been a bunch of every song by an artist type projects on various bands. And the majority of them are just kind of, here's the information that's already out there assembled in a pleasing package. There's been a select few that are actually deeply researched and reported, and I knew I would only do it if it was deeply researched and reported. And that's what I did. I literally kind of agreed to do it because I didn't want someone else to do a Springsteen book like this and screw it up. So yeah, that was kind of my goal, is to add something to the historical record while also telling the stories really well.
Yeah, it was interesting because today I was at my day job. I was telling a few people that I was interviewing you and asking them what are their favorite Springsteen song, and I got such a wide range of answers. So I think this is going to do really well, and I know it's off to a fantastic start. So let me ask you, you gave us already some background. I know you interviewed a lot of people. You've interviewed Springsteen himself, but specifically for this. So tell me a little bit. I would imagine some tracks must have been a lot easier to research than others. So tell me about maybe one or two tracks. What stood out to you? Maybe the process or something that even you found out, which I know you're a huge Springsteen historian. So just tell us about one or two songs and what stood out to you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them were hard in different ways. The ones that were well known were harder because there were so many people to talk to, and so much stuff that's already out there that you need to go past what's out there and try to find something new. With the stuff that's less discussed, it's just a wide open field. So that was both hard and easy. But I mean, you know, there's a couple ones I keep coming back to. I mean, I really love, I've said this in other interviews, but I really love the entry for the song Sandy, 4th of July, Asbury Park. And what's cool about it is it's an example of research more than interviews in this case, because I was curious about July 4th, 1973 in Asbury Park, because that's the apparent setting of the song. The song came out in 1973 after July, and it's called July 4th, at 4th of July Asbury Park. So I was like, well, what happened with the fireworks in Asbury Park on July 4th, 1973? I was really curious. Anything special? Maybe not, but I'll look it up. And so I dug into the archives. I found the Asbury Park Press, the local newspaper at that time, and it turned out that every year since World War II in Asbury Park, New Jersey, there were fireworks in the sky every year since World War II before and since, but not in 1973. 1973 was the only year in recent memory that there were no fireworks in Asbury Park. And Bruce was living in Bradley Beach, New Jersey, pretty close nearby, and I could establish that he was home. He didn't have a tour date. He didn't have a recording date. He was home. He was living with his girlfriend on the beach in Bradley Beach. And what seems to have happened is he must have seen the fireworks in Bradley Beach. He couldn't go to Asbury that year because that's where he would have been hanging out because that was his home turf for the last few years. And so pretty clearly what happened is he started feeling nostalgic. You know, when something's not there, that's when you miss it. So he started thinking about all those other years watching the fireworks in Asbury. And then like 16 days later or whatever it is, on July 21st, 1973, he debuts in concert a song called Sandy and records it a little bit later. And I just love the sort of detective work there and learning that, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say that is quite the private investigator take. So I know, Brian, you've done rightfully a lot of great interviews on the book. It's off to a great start. It came out last week. And you're also someone that interviews a lot of people. So I'm going to ask you very simply, out of all the interviews you've done so far, is there a question about your book and this whole project that you wish you had been asked? And what would that be? And you can answer it yourself, too, of course.
That was a tough one. You mentioned that question. That's a tough one. I don't quite have an answer to that. I mean, I'm glad that I talked to Backstreets, which is the premier sort of Bruce fan magazine and site, and that was an interview where Chris Phillips, who did the interview, really, really knows his Bruce, and that was a really cool interview. And then I also did I also did an interview with E Street Radio with Dave Marsh, the legendary rock writer, and Jim Rutola, who's the other host. And those were just talking to people who are like, you know, and it's a great pleasure to talk with you as well. But it's talking to people who are, you know, incredibly knowledgeable about the world of Bruce was just really satisfying. And I think, you know, again, it's just a mix of, it's just hopefully a mix of serving hardcore fans and also making a package that would be appealing to anyone with any degree of interest in Bruce Springsteen.
Absolutely. So one of the listeners of my podcast has a question for you, since you are a Bruce historian. So my listener, Tom Guerrero Davies, asked, in your opinion, how has Bruce managed to keep going for so long, and what has he done to avoid all the side effects of the touring life?
I think that essentially, you know, he just never did drugs, I think is the answer. I mean, the question as to why he never did drugs, I think, was because he experienced his dad maybe drinking a bit too much and didn't like what that looked and sounded like. So he always kind of avoided overuse of substances. And I think his dad also, as he wrote in his book, struggled with some mental illness and stuff. So Bruce didn't like the feeling of being out of control. So he never turned to drugs or alcohol. So I think that's a large amount of the answer. It's just he just stayed away from that stuff, and that's really how you spiral out of control. I mean, that said, this is a guy who we know from his book and from recently that it's a guy who did struggle with real depression, you know, and I think he's lucky enough that one of the things that helps his depression is playing live, you know, so the road was actually a bit of a cure for him. So I think that's part of the answer. It's because he loved it so much. He wasn't those guys for whom touring was a torture. It was in fact the only thing for a long time that made him feel good.
You think now that Robert Smith and The Cure are in, they're going to try once again to beat his record for the longest show? One thing I've learned from your podcast is they came pretty damn close once. Do you think they have a shot now, or do you think if they did, Bruce would just want to top it again?
Well, Bruce is getting up there, so I don't think it's important, personally. Not something I don't think either one of them cares that much.
Okay, so let me ask you if you have time. Some of your, obviously the book on Springsteen is fantastic. I've been really enjoying reading it, but the stuff you write on Rolling Stone, it just really stands out to me. The past year, every time I get my issue in the mail, you either have one or two features, and every year you just keep topping yourself. So I want to ask you about Jordan Peele and the movie Us. A few months ago, you did a profile of Jordan Peele before the movie came out. So I know I just saw on Twitter that you actually saw the movie. So let me ask you, how different was the movie than you expected based on your time with Jordan Peele? And let me ask you, how differently do you think you would have looked at the movie had you not done that feature with him?
Well, it's interesting. One thing, he showed me 20 minutes of the movie, and what I saw, maybe 15, but what he showed me was the scariest part of the movie. If anyone's seen it, without spoilers, because it's in the trailer, basically it's the scene, the home invasion scene is what I saw. And that is by far the most intense part of the entire movie. And for all I knew, the whole movie was like that. So I was actually a little bit nervous about seeing the movie because that part was really scary. But it turned out, I guess what surprised me the most is it wasn't that kind of super intense horror movie. For the most part, it wasn't like Clinch. It was definitely scary, and it was scarier than Get Out. But it wasn't relentlessly terrifying, like harrowing to watch. It was a lot of fun, really. But that's the funny thing, is he left me unable to really be sure, because you can imagine, if anyone who's seen it, if you just saw that part, you'd be like, oh my God, this movie's terrifying. but that was a kind of a welcome surprise. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how different it would be if I hadn't seen it. I think I would have been more scared by that part, that's for sure. But I think, you know, what's good, honestly, is I took enough time between when I interviewed him, when I saw it, that I had a pretty fresh perspective on it. I didn't go to there was an early screening. I didn't go to it. I just went on Saturday night like a normal person. And so I kind of experienced it like a regular person and really enjoyed it, you know?
Interesting. So your latest feature is on Game of Thrones. Just came out. I just got it in the mail. And you interviewed two of the young actresses, and I'm terrible with the names, but the actress that plays Sansa, Sophie Turner, and Aria Macy Williams. So I don't want to spoil it because people should absolutely read your article, because not only is the profile of the two actresses great, there are some pretty interesting hints on the finale. So let me ask you, what was enjoyable about that feature? What did you learn? I mean, I'm assuming you are a Game of Thrones fan anyway,
so tell me
a little bit about your experience covering the show.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny, the way I first became a Game of Thrones fan when I did my Peter Dinklage cover story, which is our first Game of Thrones cover story, and basically I just hadn't watched it yet, and my editor said, you're going to love the show, watch it, and then you do the interview, and I binged whatever was the first two seasons, and then instantly was a fan. So, by now I am a fan, but it's just a funny way to become a fan, for sure. I think the biggest thing is those two young women are just delightful human beings. They're really, really fun to spend time with and have great personalities. And they were just such, you can see what because it's always a shot in the dark to cast someone that young, but they were chosen so well and are so talented and so smart and so kind of wise beyond their years, and it was just a lot of fun to get to know them a little bit and to beat Sophie at bowling. As I told her, Bruno Mars beat me at bowling, and oh God, who else? Eddie Murphy. Bruno Mars and Eddie Murphy both defeated me terribly at bowling, but in this case, I had a good day. So, one out of three.
Awesome. Yeah. And like I mentioned, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, not just the profile, but there was definitely some pretty interesting hints on what's to come with the finale. So let me ask you about this. You recently, there was the news that the Rolling Stones are going to have to unfortunately postpone their U.S. tour. And you tweeted very wisely that, we need to stop taking our surviving music legends for granted. And I know you've interviewed Mick Jagger before. So tell me a little bit what that was like. I mean, I must imagine that, talk about someone who's larger than life. What was that experience like? And what was your first thought when you heard the sad news, unfortunately?
Well, hopefully he's okay. I think that if the rumor of what's wrong with him is true, then he'll be fine, hopefully. So, we'll see. basically, you know, I was worried because I encountered him as a human being, so it's a little different. I interviewed him a few times. It was really the last time I interviewed him that I felt like I really connected with him as a person, and we actually had a really good time talking. Even the publicist came in and said, "Wow, you guys were laughing a lot." And he really just wants to be, and this is true, I think, of most celebrities and most people, he really just wants to be treated very normally. He doesn't want to be treated with a lot of sort of reserve and respect and dignity and, and sort of like he's royalty. You know, he just wants to talk to another human being who treats him like a human being. And it's hard, you know, it's Mick Jagger and I remember the first time I ever talked to him, I had just started at Rolling Stone, and it was really surreal because he was talking, and it was like I was watching a documentary. But I was like, I had to keep reminding myself, this is real. He can see and hear you. You know what I mean? It's just very intense when it's someone on that level of fame. And I've now grown used to it, but you never fully grow used to it. But I think I had met him enough times, talked to him enough times that I was totally, totally relaxed, and I think he felt that, and he relaxed. And plus, we got to talk a little bit about blues harmonica. Not that I'm no great blues harmonica player, but I did say, like, I know enough that I play enough that I understand what you're talking about here, you know. So awesome. And he was just delighted, you know, because it turns out to be the closest thing to his heart is playing blues harmonica. He loves it. It's like his hobby, you know.
Awesome. So last question. This was another of your recent features, which was fantastic. You interviewed Jack Dorsey, who is the head of Twitter. And look, you know, it can be an amazing platform. I mean, the reason I'm talking to you is because Twitter exists. It has its flaws. So let me ask you, as someone who got to spend time with Jack Dorsey, has your perception of what Twitter is, what it could be, changed at all based on that interview?
You know, weirdly, not really. I think that I remain frustrated that there's, you know, for lack of a better word, that there's Nazis on Twitter is the first thing I asked Jack about. And I don't think they're doing a good enough job removing people with really frightening extremist views from the service. And I'm not talking about, you know, being a Republican or whatever. That's fine. I mean literally Nazis, you know. I'm not using a euphemism. I mean actual yeah. Nazis, of which there are some white nationalist Nazis, scary people. I think that I still see Twitter's flaws and potential greatness in exactly the same way. I think I really enjoyed talking with Jack Dorsey, and I really felt, you know, as two Gen Xers, I felt we had an awful lot in common as far as, you know, just our background and stuff. Like, he used computer BBSs in the 80s, so did I. He was really into Steve Jobs in the 80s, so was I. I just didn't go on to make $1 billion, you know. So that's where it differs.
Well, maybe if the book keeps doing well, who knows?
That's right. That's right. Well, it's selling pretty well, I got to say, but not $1 billion well.
Okay, well, Brian, I can't thank you enough. So again, everyone listening, like, this guy, if you love the pop culture you hear on our podcast, his is 100 times better. The Rolling Stone, the features in the magazine are amazing. The podcast is amazing. The book is great. So again, the book is Bruce Springsteen's The Stories Behind the Songs. You'll get the inside scoop on literally every Springsteen song. So Brian, I can't thank you enough for joining me today. Thanks so much, and best of luck with the book.
Oh yeah, thanks for having me. I always appreciate the support.
That's the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to everyone who sent in a question. As you guys know, we record a lot of these. So if you have another question on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, film, please send it in using the CalcioLand hashtag. And if you enjoyed the show, this is a free show available to all. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It takes 2 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating. If you leave a comment, Alex and I read them all. And these testimonials are great because they are from our listeners. They help us attract a bigger audience. And if you like all the content on the CalcioLand podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. We have various tiers for you just to listen to an enhanced version of the podcast. We have a tier where you can read a lot of original blogs from me. We'll have Alex once in a while do video, and I answer a lot of questions there. I think that'll be a lot of fun year-round, and especially during the transfer window. So thank you very much for the support, and we look forward to chatting with you in the next few days.